We always can give some nice stories about meditation in order to encourage you, give you energy, but also give you information on how to meditate. And this is another one of my stories about the old monk and the poor farmer. A long time ago, an old monk was walking for alms, and he passed the little simple hut of a poor farmer. The poor farmer offered him alms food, and after offering alms food, the farmer said, "Venerable sir, you're an old monk. Soon it will be the was period. Have you got a place to stay for the was?" And the old monk said, "No, not yet." So the farmer went on the ground and worshipped that old monk and said, "Venerable monk, please consent to stay the was close to me. I can build you a simple hut in the meadow next to the river. My wife can give you food every day. All we ask is that once a week on Poya Day, you come to the hut and you teach me and my wife meditation and you give some instructions to my children. Just once a week, that's all we ask." And the old monk consented. So they built a hut for the monk, and he stayed there for the 3 months of the was period. And the family, the husband, the wife, and the children, even the little dog, got to love that old monk. He was so wise and so kind that everybody loved that monk as if he was a wise old grandfather. And at the end of the was, after the Mahapawarana day, the monk told the farmer and his wife, tomorrow he would have to leave. He would have to go traveling again. And the whole family were very sad. And the children began to cry. And even the little dog put his tail between his legs and started to whine. Even the dog did not want the old monk to leave. But the old monk told the family, "You have been so kind and generous to me for the was period. And during that period, my meditation has been very, very deep. So deep that I have discovered very close by, closer than you think, there's a very large buried treasure, and I want you to have that because you are so poor. But if you want that treasure, you have to follow my instructions." "Tomorrow morning," said the old monk, "I want you to stand at the doorway to your hut and wait for the sun to rise. As the sun rises, pick up your bow and arrow. Point the bow in the direction of the rising sun. And when the sun appears over the horizon, let the arrow fly. And where that arrow falls, you will find the buried treasure." And the monk said, "And I promise that is true, because old monks don't lie." And so, even though they were sad, the old monk was going to leave them, they were very excited. The next day, they would be rich. So they did not sleep much that night. The following morning, the farmer was at the doorway of his house with the bow and arrow ready. As the sun rose, he pointed the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. And as the sun rose, he shot the arrow in the direction of the sun. And they all ran after it. His wife carrying the spade, the children, and even the dog ran after it. And where the arrow fell, The poor wife had to dig a big hole. You know what husbands are like. They tell you to do the hard work. And dug a big hole. Deeper and deeper she dug. And what did she find? Nothing. Only trouble. Because that arrow fell in the land belonging to a lawyer. And the lawyer said, that's against the law to dig in somebody else's property. I'm going to take you to court and take your farm away from you. And the wife said, it's not my fault. My husband told me to do it. And her husband said, it's not my fault. The old monk said we find a treasure here. And at that the lawyer said, old monk, old monks don't lie. What did he tell you? And when they told the instructions to the lawyer said, I know your mistake. Look at you. You're so poor. You have no muscles on your arm. You don't know how to shoot an arrow. I am fat, healthy. I've got strength. I will shoot the arrow tomorrow morning. And we'll sign a contract. They will split the treasure 50-50. And the farmer had no choice. So the following morning, the lawyer was there at the doorway to his house, waiting for the sun to rise with the bow and arrow. And as the sun rose, the lawyer shot the arrow, and it went much further. They all ran after it, the farmer, his wife, the two children, then the dog and the lawyer. And where the arrow fell, this time it was the husband's job to dig the hole. Be careful. What you tell your wife to do today, you have to do tomorrow. Karma. So the husband had to dig the hole deeper and deeper and deeper. And what did he find? Nothing. Only more trouble. Because this time the arrow fell in a field belonging to a general in the army. And the general came with his soldiers and told his soldiers, cut off that lawyer's head, and the farmer's, and the dog as well. At which point, the farmer who's digging a hole says, it's not my fault. It's this old monk's fault. He told us we'll find a big treasure here. And at that, the general told his soldiers, put away your swords, because old monks don't lie. What did the old monk tell you? Asked the general. And when the general heard the instructions, he said, I know where you made a mistake. What does a farmer or a lawyer know about archery? You have to be a trained soldier to shoot a bow and arrow. So the general said, tomorrow I will shoot the bow and arrow. And we'll split the treasure three ways, equally. So the following morning, the general was there with the bow and arrow at the doorway to the house, waiting for the sun to rise, with the lawyer, the farmer, farmer's wife, the children, and of course, the dog, yes. Don't forget the dog. And as the sun rose, the general pointed the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun, and as the sun rose, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun. Now, the general was a professional. He trained for years in shooting bows and arrows. So this went a long way. And they all ran after it, including the lawyer, and the dog as well. And where it landed, they dug a big hole. This time it was the job of the lawyer to dig the hole. He dug and dug and dug, and what did he find? Nothing, only big trouble this time. Because the arrow fell in the garden belonging to His Majesty the King. And the King arrested all of them. He arrested the general, the lawyer, the farmer, his children. They even arrested the dog as well. Because the king told all of them, it is a capital offense to destroy the king's property. Why did you do that? And the general said it was the lawyer's fault. The lawyer said it was the farmer's fault. The farmer said it was the old monk's fault. At which point, the king stopped. Old monks, don't lie. There is something strange happening here. So the king said, I'm going to put you all in jail for a few days until I can find that monk and get to the bottom of this story. After a few days, they found that monk, brought them back to the palace, and the king interviewed that monk. You have got all these people into big trouble. Why? And the old monk said, because, Your Majesty, they did not follow my instructions. What do you mean? Said the king. Your Majesty, said the old monk, I invite you to that poor man's house tomorrow. I invite you to take up the bow and arrow and follow my instructions. And I guarantee, Your Majesty, tomorrow morning you will find that treasure. And I request that you split it four ways. Even your portion, Your Majesty, will satisfy you. How much more would it satisfy the poor farmer and his family? So the following morning, the king was at the house, together with the lawyer, the general, the farmer, his wife, his two children, and their little dog, yes. And the monk. And so the king stood in the doorway to the hut, and he looked around at the monk, and the old monk said, yes, Your Majesty, correct. And then he picked up the bow and arrow as the sun rose, and the old monk said again, correct, Your Majesty. And as the sun rose, the king was about to shoot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun, and the old monk said, wrong, Your Majesty. And the king didn't understand what was wrong. And the monk explained, I never told you to shoot the arrow. I told you to let it fly. And the king understood. He was holding the arrow between his thumb and finger. He opened the thumb and finger, and he let it fly. And it fell straight down, right between his feet, right where he was standing. And there they found a great treasure, only a few foot down, enough to satisfy the king. And it satisfied the farmer, who never needed to work anymore, and even the little dog ate the best food out of a silver bowl for the rest of his life. And the moral of that story is, if you want to find the treasure of jhana, soan, enlightenment, let the arrow of craving fly, and it falls right where you are sitting, right in this present moment, right now, and there, right now, you will find a treasure which is more than you'd ever need in life. I know that is true, because I am now an old monk, and old monks don't lie. So that is the problem with people when they meditate. They shoot the arrow of craving. Over there, I want soan. Over here, I want jhana. Over there, I want psychic power. And what do they find? Nothing, only trouble. So let the arrow of craving go. Let it fly, let it fall. And where it falls, right here, in this moment, you will find the treasure of peace, stillness, jhana, enlightenment. Right here. That is how we meditate. Which is why I said at the beginning, all this wanting something to happen only causes you more problems and more difficulties. You get frustrated and disappointed because whenever you want something, you will always be disappointed. When you don't want anything at all, then you're at peace. You are still. And meditation happens automatically when you are sitting here letting go. You all know the story, I hope, of the Buddha's attendant, Ananda, and how he became Arahat. After the Buddha passed away, Ananda was Soan, but not Arahat. And all the senior monks were going to have a meeting the following day. 499 people were fully enlightened, Arahats, and Ananda was the only one who was not. To understand and appreciate how Ananda must have felt. Suppose I told everyone in this hall, maybe there's how many people? 1,500 people in this hall? Maybe. Suppose 1,500 people in this hall. Suppose I made the announcement that 1,499 of you were now Soan, and you weren't. How would you feel? Oh, that's so unfair. Everyone else is Soan and I am not. That is something like Ananda felt. So that night, Ananda meditated and meditated and meditated. He tried his very best to become enlightened. And what happened? When the dawn came, he was not enlightened. So what did he do? He gave up. He gave up and decided to take a nap before going to the big meeting with the 499 Arahats, the first council. And because he gave up, just before his head hit the pillow, he became fully enlightened, another Arahat. Why? Because he stopped trying. He let go. He let the arrow of craving fall. And where it fell, he became another Arahat. The 500th who would go to the meeting. Now according to the story, he decided to make a grand entrance. He deliberately came late to the first council. They had locked the door, and he hadn't arrived. And Ananda, he entered the cave through the keyhole. Now that is what we call making an entrance. He did that to prove that he was another Arahat, and everybody was so happy that he had done that. How come? By letting the arrow of craving fall. I will give you another simile. And this is another of the wonderful similes to show you how enlightenment works. And the problem with craving. People try and chase their dreams in life. And you know what it's like in your dreams in life, whether it's in your business, in your career, or even chasing happiness in family life. You can almost see the goal, and you move towards it, and it moves away from you. Happiness in life is often like that. It's in within reach, but as soon as you go to grasp it, it disappears and goes further away from you. And it reminds me of the story of the donkey and the carrot. Because in old times, before we had motor cars, in Europe, they used to use a donkey to pull a cart. Pull people, pull goods from place to place. But donkeys are well known for being so stubborn. They're even more stubborn than your husband. They won't do anything. Even if you get a stick and hit the donkey, the donkey still will not move. And that is not how you make a donkey pull a cart. You can hit it, beat it, it won't move at all. Instead, you tie the stick to the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is about 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you tie a string. On the end of the string, you tie a carrot. Now that may not work for Sri Lankan donkeys. You may have to put a mango in there, or a hopper, or something. So there's the donkey, sees mango in front, a juicy, sweet, ripe mango. And what does the donkey do? It moves towards the mango. When the donkey moves, the stick moves, the string moves, and the mango moves. So the mango is always 2 foot in front of donkey's mouth. That's how they get the donkey to pull the cart. And they don't need only one mango last for a week. But some years ago, Buddhism came to Europe and a donkey learned how to catch the mango. A Buddhist donkey can catch the mango very easily. What the donkey does, the donkey runs as fast as he can after the mango. Doesn't matter how fast the donkey runs, the mango is always 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. But the Buddhist donkey knows how to stop and wait and have faith. Because as soon as a donkey stops, the mango swings further away from the donkey. But the donkey's got faith. He lets the mango go. And soon the mango is 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. And then something very strange happens. The mango starts swinging towards the donkey. And the donkey just stands there. It does nothing. It is still. It doesn't move. Soon the mango is 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth in its usual position. But now it's coming at top speed towards the donkey's mouth. It swung up, back, and just before it enters the donkey's mouth, the donkey has to remember compassion, kindness, maitri. The donkey thinks, mango, the door of my mouth is open to you. Come in. If the donkey keeps the mouth closed, it bounces off its teeth. That is how the donkeys catch the carrot. Run fast, stop, mango swings back, up, back, right into the donkey's mouth. That is how you catch jhana. So one, enlightenment. You've been wanting it all your life. Stop. And the peace of mind, jhana, so on, goes further away from you. Stop. Don't do anything. And soon it starts swinging towards you. And you have to remember when it gets very close, the door of my heart is open to you, mango. So on, jhana, enlightenment, come in. That is how you become a so on. You chase things and it's craving. You let them go and it comes to you. That is a strange thing in life, but that is so true when it comes to meditation. Any experience, any state of meditation, if you chase it, you chase it away. If you are still, it may go away a little bit, but then it will come back to you. That is how you meditate. So, when you're really still and peaceful, all these beautiful states, they come to you. Already mentioned early this morning, just you learn how to let go and be in the present moment. Just like that farmer, let go of the arrow of craving. It falls right where you are in this very moment. In the present moment, after a while, your mindfulness starts to increase. You start to get happier and happier and more aware. You start to be able to see things you haven't seen before. Everything becomes more beautiful as your mind becomes stronger. It's a strange thing which I found in meditation. At first I never understood why this happens, but it did. The first time I went on a meditation retreat, I was still a student at Cambridge. So we hired 3 boarding houses during vacation. And that's where we were going to meditate for 9 days. Now, these were boarding houses for students in the late 60s, early 70s. Those of you who went to UK to study in that time, one thing you'll always remember about England in the 60s and 70s, the food was terrible. Everything was boiled, and so there was no taste left at all. So many people from Sri Lanka, that was a lot of suffering. You probably took some of your curry powders and other things with you to somehow give the food some taste. And the worst of all cooks in the whole country, the bottom of the pile, the least competent, were the ones who were employed to cook for poor students like me. So when I heard I was going to have 9 days of boarding house food, I thought I'd better take some sandwiches or something to survive. But I had very good meditation on that retreat. And something else happened as well. The food became delicious. I couldn't understand why it was. This was boarding house food, and it was tasty, it was delicious. I now know the boarding house food was as tasteless as usual, but my mind was so strong that the last piece of flavor after all that boiling, I could pick up. My mind had made all my senses very, very sensitive, so I can pick up the flavor and enjoy it. And to this day, I tell people, if you want a delicious lunch or dinner, meditate for 1 hour beforehand, and you'll find the food tastes even more delicious. Not only that, people tell me, they go on retreats, and their eyes become so sensitive, when they go home, they look at their old wife, and she looks more beautiful than ever before. You can pick up the beauty, where when you're dull, you can't see that. And this is a sign that your mindfulness is becoming really strong. Even the old carpet in front of you becomes beautiful. There's an old poem by the English poet William Blake. To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, see eternity in an hour. It's an old poem by a painter and poet in the late 1600s, early 1700s. And if you're a meditator, you know exactly what he means. To see a world in a grain of sand, something so small, when your mindfulness gets very strong, in just a little grain of sand you can see so much. To see a heaven in a tiny flower, which most people will miss, when mindfulness gets strong, even in a small flower, is incredibly beautiful. Which is why when you meditate and your mindfulness gets strong, you look at the leaves outside and it's like they've been polished. They're greener than green. The sky is bluer than any blue you've ever seen before. That's a sign that mindfulness has happened. And one of my stories, which is a true story, but it's a little bit gross. But it's funny at this time of the day because you want to wake up. Once I was on a retreat and I was getting very strong meditation, really powerful meditation, and I had to go to the toilet. So I went to the toilet, and after going to the toilet, I had a look in the toilet bowl. Wow! I've never seen such a beautiful piece of feces in my life. It wasn't just brown, it was all the different shades of brown. And the way it was put together, a ball here, it was like a sculpture by Rodin or by Michelangelo. And I don't know if you've noticed, but there's always a tiny bit of mucus on the outside, which make it sparkle like a diamond. And I haven't even gone into the aroma, the scent, which was so full and rich. That's a true story. I was looking in that bowl and thinking, wow, this is beautiful. I should take it out and put it on the wall. But then, I never did. Because I'm a monk, I know how to let go. I pressed the button and it washed away. That was so hard to let something so beautiful disappear. But joking aside, that's what happens. When you get into strong mindfulness, now even a piece of feces looks incredibly beautiful. Let alone a flower. Let alone your breath. That is where the delightful breath comes from. Your mindfulness has become powerful. Whatever you watch is so gorgeous. So you get to this stage, you're so still and peaceful that the energy comes into your mind and you're watching this breath come in, go out, and it's gorgeous. So much so that on these retreats, you know, people keep atasil, 8 precepts. There is no dinner in the evening for them. And it's just before lunchtime, they're meditating. They know if they don't get up and have lunch, that's it for the day. And they have the choice. 11 o'clock, 11:30, they're watching the breath, so lovely, breathing in, breathing out. Should I have lunch or should I carry on meditating? And they carry on meditating. That's how delightful it is. So delicious and so beautiful because your mindfulness has now started to get power. And that is what I really wish for everybody in BMICH sometime in their life. To be able to meditate and get so delight in their meditation, their breath is just gorgeous. So they can watch it without any effort for hour after hour. Not through force, because, as the Buddha said, the piti sukha, the happiness, starts to arise. And when you start to get happiness in meditation, I tell people, you don't really need me anymore. Off you go. You meditate for hours and hours and hours. It's only a matter of time before jhanas come. Simply because you're enjoying it so much, you can't meditate enough. When I have a meditation retreat in Australia, it's booked up in about 1 or 2 minutes. We say there's a certain time you can book. And people actually get online on the internet, they start typing in, before they finish typing, it's all full. You know what? One of my proudest achievements in life, I was teaching just a Dhamma talk in Indonesia. And it was the same time that this American pop star, Lady Gaga, have you heard of Lady Gaga? She was also visiting Indonesia. Now, because I'm very popular in Indonesia as well, they had to give these passes out. And they did charge people, but just only a small amount, 20 cents or 30 cents. know, for the tickets, just to limit the number of people who could come. My tickets sold out in 45 minutes. Lady Gaga took 4 hours to sell her tickets. So I realize I'm more popular than Lady Gaga. I really like that. But the meditation retreats are very popular. Why is that? Because people have so much happiness coming on a meditation retreat. Now, I've often quoted the Lord Buddha, because sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you make this up yourself. It's not really the Buddha's teachings, but it is. I often quote the Dharmacaya Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, because there the King Pasenadi went to visit the Lord Buddha in the Jetavana Monastery, Anathapindika's Park, just outside of Sawati. Probably the most famous monastery in India at the time of the Buddha. The place where the Buddha spent more time than anywhere else. And when the king came in to see the Lord Buddha, he kissed the Buddha's feet and he said to the Lord Buddha how much he loved coming into this monastery, this Arama. And the Lord Buddha asked him, why do you like coming to the temple so much? And the king said, because in this monastery, in this Arama, the monks are always smiling and happy. And the Buddha replied, and this is the important point, yes, great king, said the Lord Buddha, that is what you can expect when the monks' meditation is starting to progress and insight is starting to arise. The monks become happy and smiling. So I know if your meditation is progressing because your mouth starts to turn up at the sides. Up and up and up. You get happy. That is what happens according to the Lord Buddha, when meditation starts to really develop. And what that also means is when people see you being so happy and you tell them it's because you're meditating, that makes more people want to meditate than anything else. When they see others being happy and they ask you why, they also want part of that joy and happiness. The beautiful, peaceful, wonderful happiness of a powerful mind. So this is what you can expect when you start to meditate more and more properly. If you start to struggle and strive and shoot the arrow of craving, wanting something, what do you find? Nothing, only trouble. That is not the way to meditate. Letting go. Being peaceful, putting the cup of water down, then it becomes still by itself. Letting the arrow of craving fall, letting it go, and just being here, stopping. And then the carrot or the mango comes towards you. That is how to meditate. That is where you learn how to be happy. Just like the Buddha was craving, struggling for 6 years before he tried letting go, gaining jhanas under the famous Bodhi tree. Talking about the Bodhi tree, or mango trees, one of my masters, Ajahn Chah's greatest similes, which fits into this part of today's, this afternoon's Dhamma Desana. One of his greatest similes was what he taught me the first year I was under his training. He said his monastery in Thailand was a mango orchard where the mango trees had been planted by the Buddha himself. And I realized this was just a simile. And he continued, the mango trees were planted by the Buddha, and today there are so many ripe juicy, sweet mangoes on those trees. And you monks, nuns, upasaka, upasikas, laymen and laywomen, because of the great compassion and wisdom of the Buddha, you don't need to shake the tree to get a mango to fall. You don't need to get a stick and throw it at the mango to get it to fall. And you don't need to climb the tree to get the mangoes. Because of the great wisdom and compassion of the Buddha, all you need to do is sit perfectly still under the mango tree. Hold out your hand and a mango will fall right into it. When I first heard that, I did not understand it at all. You have many mango trees here in Sri Lanka, even in Colombo. Have you ever tried sitting under the mango tree, opening out your hand and having one fall in? If it did fall, it would probably fall on your head. So what did my master mean? My teacher obviously meant this was not a real mango. This was what we call the paths and fruits. Things like jhanas and so on. Sakadagami, Anagami, Arahat. If you want one of those fruits, please do not shake the mango tree. Don't throw sticks up to try and get it. Certainly don't climb up there. If you want one of the great fruits of the Dhamma, you have to learn how to sit perfectly still. Don't move. Just like the donkey, stay still and open up your heart with Maitri, and a mango will fall. Jhanas, so on. Just like Ananda, still letting go, and these beautiful things fall into your hand. That is how it works. The reason why people don't get these states of mind, they don't get jhanas, they don't get so on, is because you don't know how to be still. You don't know how to stop. You're always going somewhere. Many years ago, one of my friends in my temple in Perth said, "How are you, Ajahn Brahm?" And I answered in English, "I'm getting there." And then he asked me, "Where exactly is it you're getting to?" And I realized, for many people, we're always getting somewhere. We're never arriving, are we? We're always going somewhere else. You arrive here and you're thinking of the next place you will go to. We're always on the move, going to the next thing, the next appointment, the next meditation state. We're always going somewhere. Which is why when I travel the world and I go to many places, I always see, or actually I never see, it's very rare to see a human being. I see many human goings, but very few human beings. I hope you understand the difference between a human being and a human going. You're being here, enjoying this moment, not worrying about where you're going next. That's called a human being instead of a human going. If you want to get jhanas, so on, you've got to stop going places and be here. Now what happens when you get these beautiful states of mind? You're not going anywhere, you've let go of craving, you've just got this beautiful breath, peaceful going in, going out, you've got happiness and joy. Piti Sukha has arisen. Any of you who study Anapanasati Sutta, you see that's the fifth and sixth stages. That's what the Buddha asks you to do, to develop Piti Sukha. The happiness and joy. And that's what you're doing at that stage of the meditation. What happens next? You're enjoying yourself so much in this meditation. that you don't put any effort in at all. You don't need to. You're having fun. How much effort do you need to put in when you're watching the cricket on TV? Do you need to strive? Only another half an hour to go. I must keep looking at the TV. It's natural. You're enjoying it. Or if you're watching your favorite movie, for those of you who don't like cricket, does it take effort to watch an exciting movie? Because it's enjoyable, it captures your attention and keeps you there hour after hour after hour. Even those people, because just before lunch I was giving a meditation, it was very noisy outside. Do you get disturbed by noise when you're meditating? You know, I had a couple of disciples in Perth. They were Malaysian born, living in Perth. They were watching the TV one day in their lounge room. It was a movie, and once the movie had finished, one of them got up to go to the toilet, and the other one went up to make a cup of tea. And when they got up from the sofa, they discovered that in the room where they had been sitting, many things were missing. A burglar, true story, had come into their house while they were watching the TV and stole things from the shelf right behind where they were sitting. That was a very cheeky burglar, but they were so interested in watching the movie, they couldn't hear the burglar right behind them. And I told them, if only you can do that in meditation, being able to watch the breath and not even hear the person sitting next to you, then you'll be a good meditator. You can do that when you're watching a movie or you're doing something very interesting. So when you get the joy and happiness in the meditation, it means you don't get disturbed by sounds outside because you're having too much joy and happiness. And what happens next is because you're not doing anything, because the happiness is keeping you still. The breath, you don't need so much oxygen. A car which is still doesn't need to burn so much petrol. So the energy increases in mindfulness. The body becomes more still. You don't need so much oxygen. So the breath gets softer and lighter until the breath disappears. It's gone. It's not there anymore. You can't feel it. And what is left? Now this is a bit of serious meditation advice here. Some people get to that stage, the breath vanishes, and there's nothing left. It's just darkness, nothing really happening, and they get a bit bored. The reason is because they never developed enough piti sukha before the breath disappeared. Not enough energy, not enough brightness in their mindfulness. If you follow the instructions carefully, remember, old monks don't lie. If you follow the instructions carefully, developing this delightful breath before the breath vanishes, then when the breath vanishes, your mindfulness is so strong, that's where you start to see the beautiful lights. The nimittas appear in the mind. When they do appear in the mind, again, they're very joyful. If there's not enough piti sukha, happiness and joy in the mind, you can't really develop the nimittas. So please, develop that happiness. And then when the breath vanishes, you have these beautiful lights in the mind called the nimittas. That is actually the ninth stage of Anapanasati. Because that light you see in the mind is a reflection of the citta. As I said, I think this morning or previous day, when you look in your face in the mirror in the morning, what you're seeing is a reflection of your face in the mirror. What you're seeing this light is a reflection of your citta. But there may be a problem there, because if your nimitta, the light you see in meditation, is a bit stained or dirty, that means you have not been keeping your five precepts. You cannot lie, because the nimitta, the citta you see, that's real. And if you have been angry to your husband, if you have been you know, drinking a bit of alcohol with your friends, the light you see is not pretty at all. It's not beautiful. I remember one of the first times I taught this many years ago in Kuala Lumpur. This young man came up to me very disturbed. He said, I just got a nimitta up in my meditation and it was so dirty, like an oil rag used to clean the car. And I said, yes, what have you been doing? He said, I'm sorry, Ajahn Brahm. He'd been breaking his precepts. And this is one of the first times you see the power of Sila, of precepts, in meditation. If you have been keeping precepts, if you are a generous person, give donations to the temples, and if you are a kind person, always helping out people, helping out the temple, one of these people who cleans up afterwards when everyone goes home. If you're a person like that, your nimitta is beautiful. You know that sometimes we call people pure-hearted people? Why are they pure-hearted? Because they're always there, they never criticize, they never think of themselves, always given to other people. Those pure-hearted people, when these lights come up, they are actually gorgeous. It reminds me, the best people in any temple are the ones who clean up afterwards. Not the ones who sit in the front, not the ones who offer all these gifts, but the ones who stay behind to tidy up afterwards. Because that reminds me of the story of the five fingers. There was once five fingers and they were arguing who is the most important finger. And the thumb said, I am the most important finger. I am strong. I am tough. And also, when you say, okay, Harry, which finger do you put up? Me. I am the okay finger. I am the best. And then this finger put herself up. Say, no, I am the best finger. I am the finger of wisdom. I point things out to people. And wisdom is the most powerful force in the world. And when you say number one, who do you hold up? Me, number one. I am the number one finger. So that left this middle finger. And he said, actually, I am the best finger. I am the tallest, so I can see further. Also, I am the middle finger. And the Lord Buddha said, middle way is the best way. And if you don't believe how powerful I am, just hold me up the other way. And people get very upset. That's how I am the most powerful, biggest finger. And that left this finger. And this finger said, you are all wrong. I am the best finger, because I am the finger of love. When you get engaged, I receive engagement ring. When you get married, I receive the wedding ring. I am the finger of love. Without love, where would the world be? So I, the finger of love, am the best finger. And that left this little fellow. And who would ever think that this is the best finger? So small, so weak, right at the very end. And this little finger said, you are all wrong. I am the most important finger. And I'll tell you why. Even though people use me to do dirty things, still, said the little finger, when you worship the Buddha, I am always closest to the Buddha. So the people who do the dirty things in the temple, clean up, wash the dishes, clean the toilets, they do dirty things, though only little, where they are always closest to the Buddha. Remember that. So, even though you do dirty things, if it's the right dirty thing, like helping the temple, when your nimitta comes up, the light is beautiful, it's gorgeous. You've got a pure heart, so what you see is really pure. And nimittas like that, you just stay with them, they're so attractive, that soon those nimittas pull you right inside. And that becomes the experience of the jhana. So much bliss. But because it's bliss, you can't get out. You stay in those states for long periods of time. The five senses can't really come up. You can't be disturbed by sounds or feelings. And to give you an example, one story before I have to leave for the next one. One of my disciples in Perth, he was not meditating all that much, maybe half an hour a day. But it was a Sunday afternoon in Perth. And he was bored, so he told his wife, "I'm going into my bedroom to meditate." After an hour and a half, he hadn't come out from his bedroom. So his wife went to check up on him and saw him meditating still, after an hour and a half, sitting perfectly still, too still. She couldn't see him breathing. So she called 999 to get the ambulance. And the ambulance came within 5 minutes. And the medics rushed into the bedroom. They felt his pulse. There was no pulse. So they put him on the stretcher, put him in the ambulance, and they rushed him to the hospital. Do 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 do. With the sirens going, whoosh, rushing through all the red lights. This was an emergency. There was no pulse. And these were trained medics. They could find no pulse at all. When they got to the hospital, it was emergency. They rushed him in to the emergency room. They put on, first of all, ECG to see if there was any heartbeat. Flat line. No beeps at all. They put on the EEG to see if there's any brain activity. Another flat line. My disciple was clinically dead. So, usually, they'd have taken him straight down to the morgue. It was very good luck they did not do that. Because he would come out of meditation later. Imagine you put someone down in the morgue, you think they're dead, and they come alive afterwards. It usually kills the attendants who are in the morgue. He was just meditating, that's all. And so, the good fortune was, the doctor on duty that day had migrated from India, and he had heard that sometimes some yogis in meditation can get so still they can calm all their bodily activities. And he thought, wife said he'd been meditating, maybe this is one of those cases. So they never took him to the morgue. And interestingly, what the wife said was the only difference. The strange thing was, he wasn't cold, he was still warm. And if ever you look, I think it's in the Churavedala Sutra, they say the difference between a person in deep meditation and the one who is dead is that they are still warm, they don't go cold. So if your husband or wife looks like she's dead, don't cremate her yet. See if she's still warm. If she's still warm, leave her. She's only meditating, that's all. So, they put defibrillators on his body, these electric shocks. You may have seen it in the movies, or you may have actually gone to a hospital and see it happening, which shocks the body, trying to get the heart going again. Many times, shock the body to try and get the heart going, the brain going. Nothing worked for a long time, according to his wife who was with him, until he told me this. He just decided time to come out of meditation. He opened his eyes, beep, beep, beep. ECG and EEG were perfect. So what am I doing here? I was in my bedroom. How did I get into hospital? And the doctor gave him thorough examination, could find absolutely nothing wrong with him, so he walked home with his wife that afternoon. That's a true story. What it's like to get into these jhanas. Even you have defibrillators on your body, you can't feel it. Even if you have the silence, you can't hear a thing. I said, what will you experience during that time? The most wonderful bliss you could ever imagine. So peaceful, so lovely, so wonderful. The best experience of my life. That is what jhana is like. But please, do not worry what might happen to me if my wife or husband gets it wrong and they do cremate me. Because that actually happened in the sutras. There was a monk meditating in the forest in the jungle. And he was so still that when two villagers came past, they thought the venerable monk had passed away. And they were Buddhists. We can't let a venerable monk be eaten by the forest animals. We will have to cremate him. And they were in the forest, the jungle anyway. So they quickly got some wood. And they put the venerable monk on top. And they lit the wood. And when the fire was well established, they went off to do their gathering of herbs or mushrooms, whatever they were in the forest for. Because they knew the fire would burn the venerable now. And you can imagine their surprise and how impressed they were the following day when the venerable monk came into their village for alms round. Not even his robe was burned. And that's what happens to you if you get into the jhana and you get cremated. After your cremation, when they pull out the tray, if it's the modern crematoriums, you say, "Hi, it's me again." Okay, so I've got to finish now. I can go on for a long time with these stories. But that is a little bit of entertainment, nice, interesting stories, all about meditation. I hope you enjoyed that. Interesting, nice stories. Now, the old monks don't lie. Let go of the arrow of craving. Chasing the cow as a donkey. Stop, the cow will come to you. Sitting under the tree. Just be still. Hold out your hand. Mango will fall. These are the stories. And also remember, what is the most important finger? The one which does the dirty work. Always closest to the Buddha. Thank you for listening.